My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
Hi everybody, welcome back to another edition of My Classic Album, the show where we look back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris, and a bit of an apology that we've had a gap between episodes. It was unexpected, a bit of a summer break if you like. But we're here for another episode of My Classic Album, and for a few weeks now, since our previous episode, dedicated to the Black Album by Metallica, and thank you very much to Calvin Lever for joining me to chat about one of my favourite albums of all time, by one of my favourite bands of all time. Since that episode, I have been teasing and promising this episode dedicated to Blood Sugar Sex Magik, the album that catapulted the career of Red Hot Chili Peppers. And that is today's episode, and I'll be joined by Elizabeth Evarts in just a little bit to break that album down and chat all about it. And I'm very excited for you to finally hear my conversation with Elizabeth. So what else have I been up to while we've been having a bit of a break from the podcast? Well, I went to see Kiss. That was pretty amazing. It's only the second time that I've been lucky enough to see Kiss, and chances are it could be the last time. They are on their end of the road tour, their farewell tour, which in the middle of July kind of wound up the European stint. I think it's going on for 3 years. Wound up that European thing. I could see him maybe come back for one or two of the festivals, maybe play Download again before it's all said and done. But in terms of an arena tour, that is it. That'll be the last time they'll play Newcastle, I imagine. And I know some people are probably laughing and thinking, oh, well, you know, they've said this before. You know, the guys are getting on. Gene Simmons just turned 70 last week. I have a feeling that this is literally the end of the road after this tour. And what a way to sign off. They were absolutely phenomenal. I last saw them on the Sonic Boom tour in 2010. Sonic Boom over Europe. And this just blew that even out of the water. That's always a gig that I remember. The one back in 2010. I remember that as one of the best gigs I ever saw, certainly the best I've ever seen in the arena in Newcastle. But this just blew it away, 1,000,000%. It was just absolutely phenomenal. My wife had never seen Kiss before. I know that she was anticipating it greatly to see what kind of show it was. And I think, obviously, she was impressed by the band, but also just the spectacle of a Kiss show. And if you've been to see Kiss or seen it live on like a DVD or anything, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. They just put their pedal to the metal and they just go for it every time. Explosions, fire, pyro, fireworks, ticker tape, blood, you name it, it's there. And, you know, anyone who's seen Kiss before, and I know we have a lot of Kiss fans who listen to the podcast. We've done a couple of their albums in the past. I hope that you get the opportunity to see Kiss once more before it's all said and done. I know looking through my Twitter feed that Beth Blade, who chose Hotter Than Hell, and Rob Wilde, who chose Crazy Nights, got the chance to see Kiss on this tour, which I'm really, really pleased about. You know, they're just a phenomenal band, and I don't care what anyone says. If you get a chance to catch them on this End of the Road tour, please do so. It's going to be the last time that you're going to get to see a legendary band do their thing. So, by all means, catch Kiss if they come in your neck of the woods. And I think if they do play one of the festivals before it's all said and done, I'm certainly going to make an effort to get there. You know, They're just fab. I've got a couple of other gigs coming up later this year that I'm going to try and showcase my experiences on the podcast, depending kind of how things are going. I'm going to see Adam Ant at the Sage in Gateshead at the beginning of November. And again, I saw him around 2010, 2011. And my wife's a huge fan. I'd kind of gone really more because she was a fan. But I came away really enjoying the show. I thought it was absolutely awesome. So I'm looking forward to seeing Adam again. and he is playing Friend of Foe, the album, in full. Which, you know, for someone like me who's a bit of a geek about the album as a format, that should be good fun. And I love it when I get to see a band and they play an album in full. There's just something about that that's really cool. You know, I've seen Metallica do Master of Puppets. I've seen Meat Loaf do Battered to Hell, just for a couple of examples. And it's always good fun to hear the album in sequence as was intended in a live setting. It's always a lot of fun. And then a show that I am very, very excited about, which is happening a couple of weeks after Adamant. I'm traveling down to Leeds to see Ghost. So people who follow our social media pages will know that I picked Prequel as my album of the year last year. And there was some stiff competition because Big Boy Bloater released an awesome album in Pills. And Blackstone Cherry's Family Tree came out last year, which was another just, I love that album to death. But Prequel, just from start to finish in terms of it being an album, as the sum of its parts, is just phenomenal. And I'm so excited that I'm going to get to go and see Ghost. For anyone who's listened to the podcast way, way back, I'm actually going with Ian Matthews, who joined me for episode 2 to talk about OK Computer. So I will definitely give you an opportunity to let you know what the experience is like going to a Ghost show. And, you know, I'm very, very much looking forward to that. Around the same time in November, my classic album will be celebrating 40 years of The Wall by Pink Floyd. We've had these anniversary episodes before. We've revisited Battered to Hell. We've revisited Hysteria and Rumours. So this is another fantastic album that it's just going to be so much fun to delve into and to find a little bit more about. I like to try and make these episodes a bit special. So if you've got any connection to the album, any stories that you want to tell me, any information about it that you think would be worth sharing with the world, get in touch on our social media pages. Get yourself to Facebook and search for My Classic Album with Mike Norris. Get yourself on Instagram and follow My Classic Album Podcast. Or alternatively, you could follow us on Twitter at @MCA_podcast. All this information is up on www.myclassicalbum.co.uk, and I will give you more information about 40 Years of The Wall as the weeks roll on. But that will be coming in November, and I'm very excited that we're finally doing some Pink Floyd. The Wall is a great album, and I'm looking forward to getting stuck in. Right, well, that keeps us kind of up to date. I felt like it was nice to have a bit of a catch up after I've been away for a few weeks. But let's just get into it. My special guest today is Elizabeth Evarts, and she has chosen Blood Sugar Sex Magic from the Red Hot Chili Peppers. But before we get to Elizabeth and my chat with her, let's just have a look at the facts. Here's the beginning of what you need to know about Blood Sugar Sex Magic. Blood Sugar Sex Magic is the fifth studio album from Californian rock band Red Hot Chili Peppers. The album was second by the band to boast a formidable lineup of Anthony Kiedis, Flea, Chad Smith and John Frusciante following 1989's Mother's Milk. Blood Sugar Sex Magic was produced by Rick Rubin, who suggested the band record their album at The Mansion, a former residence of Harry Houdini, which was said to be home to paranormal activity. The quirky environment energised the band, and the finished album was released on the 24th of September 1991 through Warner Brothers Records. The High Energy Give It Away was chosen as the lead single, released a couple of weeks ahead of the main album. It proved a breakthrough for the band, garnering them their first number one on the US Billboard Modern Rock Track charts and cracking the Billboard Hot 100 at number 73. The song also proved popular in the UK, charting at number 9 in 1993. Under the Bridge proved to be an even bigger smash, reaching the top of the singles charts across the world, albeit just missing out on the top of the Billboard Hot 100, charting at number 2. Suck My Kiss and Breaking the Girl were also released in some territories, scoring further hits for the band. The success of its singles and the growing popularity of Red Hot Chili Peppers solidified Blood Sugar Sex Magic as a breakthrough album for the band. Blood Sugar Sex Magic reached number 3 on the Billboard 200 in the US and number 5 on the UK album charts, certifying 7 and 3 times platinum respectively. Not only that, but Blood Sugar Sex Magic reached number 1 in countries such as Canada, New Zealand and Australia, signalling the arrival of Red Hot Chili Peppers as one of the biggest bands in the world. Over time, the album has been held in high regard and is seen as one of the biggest albums of the 90s and one of the creative peaks of Red Hot Chili Peppers. Spin magazine named it 58th in its top 90 albums of the 90s. Blood Sugar Sex Magic was also ranked number 310 on Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Albums of All Time in 2003. So that's just the beginning of what we need to know about Blood Sugar Sex Magic, and I have here with me my special guest, who chose the album to talk about today on My Classic Album. This is Elizabeth Evarts. How's it going?
Yeah, great. Thanks so much for having me, Mike.
Yeah, no, it's lovely to have you. Just before we kind of dig in too much, why have you chosen Blood Sugar Sex Magic to talk about on My Classic Album today?
Well, it's an album that I've listened to so very many times because it's such a long album that just has tons of wonderful, wonderful songs. You know, there's a lot of albums out there and I love many albums, but I felt that this album has such a huge amount of strong songs on it that it's worth talking about.
Absolutely, yeah. And so what are those memories of you hearing this album for the first time?
Yeah, well, I was young, but I did buy the tape. I remember it was a black tape. And I had already followed the Red Hot Chili Peppers in their first, okay, I was young, so I didn't follow them really from the beginning. I discovered them and I loved their first five albums. But this one was different. And yeah, I just remember feeling amazed that each song would come on. The album, some albums have sort of a shape like a hill, you could say, but this one was just hill after hill after hill. It just seemed to go on and on, and there was so much quality on there. So I just remember listening to it a lot. And of course, on the tape, you have the two sides. And yeah, I would just listen to it and listen to it again. And it was amazing music.
Yeah. So Blood Sugar Sex Magik is regarded within the career of the Red Hot Chili Peppers as a truly defining moment. Mm-hmm. I personally, for me, it's between this and Californication as to what is their true creative peak. I love both albums. Mm-hmm. What is it that you think is about Blood Sugar Sex Magik that's so special? Is it that nostalgic quality to it that you remember discovering it for the first time and all that kind of thing?
Well, to be honest, after this album, I didn't really follow them as closely anymore. So okay. I know Californication, but for me, it was just a personal decision. I had moved on and I was really interested in other artists after that. And I guess I just love the funk so much on this album. You know, you just want to dance and I love singing along with it. So I love the way Anthony Kiedis vocalizes. And there's just so many good lyrics and so much awesome stuff on Blood Sugar Sex Magik. So yeah. I think that's why.
Yeah, it almost sounds like for you that this album was the peak and there was almost no hope of them being able to top this album.
Yeah, and that's maybe my own problem, my own fault. But yeah, that's kind of where it was. It was too good. It was so good.
Yeah, I mean, this is the second album by the band to boast what many would agree is the classic lineup of Red Hot Chili Peppers. So we've already talked about Anthony Kiedis on vocals. We've got Flea on bass, Chad Smith on the drums, and of course, John Frusciante on guitar. What is it about this lineup of the band that's so universally beloved?
I'm not sure if I'm right, but I think that when John Frusciante joined the band, because he joined at Mother's Milk, I believe.
Yeah.
And then I think in this album, I think he had a lot of influence over the writing the songs. I'm not sure, but I think so because of he's such a strong player and performer and the styles. He's so versatile. He can play so many different guitar styles, like you have Breaking the Girl or there's so much. And I think that they, of course, all have a chemistry together, but I do think that he maybe took it a little bit a different direction with the songwriting. I'm not sure.
I mean, as we've talked about a little bit there already, this is the second album from this lineup. The first one is Mother's Milk. Which came out in 1989. You'd said that you listened to those previous albums by the Chili's. How does Mother's Milk and Blood Sugar Sex Magik, how do they differ?
For me, and it's funny, since we were going to do this podcast, I did a little bit more reading. And, you know, back in the 90s, there was not really internet or I loved the band, but I didn't know all this background information. So it was kind of interesting. I mean, my own impression of Mother's Milk, I always loved that album too. But again, yeah, for me, it just the songs were great, but the style of the songs is different. And I read recently that they had been pressured in that album to try to get more listeners. So say to think more about their listeners and their songwriting during Mother's Milk. And for me, if that's true, that does kind of seem that way. And in Blood Sugar Sex Magik, it feels like they're totally free.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting that you talk about this kind of almost kind of compromising of the sound. Mm-hmm. John and Anthony particularly struggled with the direction that Michael Beinhorn, who produced Mother's Milk, wanted that album to take. And Anthony talks about that in his autobiography, Scar Tissue. He says he wanted John to have a big, crunching, almost metal-sounding guitar tone, whereas before, we always had some interesting acid rock guitar tones, as well as a lot of slinky, sexy, funky guitar tones. I couldn't tolerate his direction any longer. He was trying to squeeze something out of me that I wasn't feeling, and we got into a fight, and I knew that I was done with him. So it seems like that production of Mother's Milk, as you've maybe touched on when you've listened to it, was somewhat a little troubled, and the band maybe want to move on from that and set themselves free a little bit, I guess.
Yeah. And maybe that was even enhanced because that was, say, from one album to the next. So if you've been put as an artist, if you have, I mean, really, as an artist, I think you really want to think about the art and not about your audience. And if you're pressured to, that can interfere with the artistic process, and maybe them breaking, standing up for that, and breaking free from that, it could have created a really amazing energy that went into this album, Blood Sugar Sex Magic.
So with Beinhorn out of the picture, the hunt is on for a new producer for their next album. And it's a longtime admirer of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Rick Rubin, put himself forward to work with the band on Blood Sugar Sex Magic. Now, this is the 32nd episode of My Classic Album. This is actually the first Rick Rubin album that we've covered on My Classic Album, surprisingly. But of course, he's a household name, one of the most successful producers of all time.
Yeah.
Are you a fan of Rick's production on this album and his production style in general?
Yeah, I am.
So funnily enough, the band were actually reluctant to have Rick on board the project initially. At this point in his career, Rick's working with bands like Slayer, Beastie Boys, Run DMC. This is a producer who's certainly not afraid to brush with very broad strokes as a producer.
Yeah, true.
So the relationship between the band and Rick was and is obviously a very strong one, as Rick would go on to produce every album following Blood Sugar Sex Magic until their most recent album, The Getaway.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, I believe The Getaway was literally the first album since this one that he didn't work on with them. So that bond that they made with him is quite significant.
Yeah.
Do you get that feeling when you're listening to the album? I mean, we've touched on a few albums recently over the past few months where a lot of its success is down to getting the right producer and that good bond in the studio with a band. How important is that?
I think it's really important. And I think, I don't know if you want to touch on this now, but I know because I had this documentary on this album, Funky Monks. I'm sure you're familiar with that. Yeah. So it's not only about the producer and the studio, but that they made that house into a studio. And I think they all lived there except for Chad, because he would go home every evening. But I think that also just creates, you know, I think you hear so much in the music. You hear love, you hear creativity, you hear inspiration, you hear the rooms. I mean, just in general, too. I think that's why I'm really against a sterile and musical environment, even if the quality would be top. It needs to live and breathe.
Absolutely, yeah. And just before we touch on The Mansion, because that is a really important part of this album, like you say.
I've got
a quote from Anthony talking about the bond they made with Rick, and in a weird way this makes complete sense. So this is about the dynamic in play during those sessions. He said, if Baron von Munchausen had ejaculated the four of us being the Red Hot Chili Peppers onto a chessboard, I think Rick Rubin would be the perfect chess player for that particular board.
Typical. quote. Yeah, oh, that's funny.
But again, it makes complete sense. Like, so out there, typically Anthony Kiedis, but you're like, you're right. So as we've been talking about there already, the band expressed a desire to record somewhere different to the usual somewhat sterile studio experience. Rick suggested recording at The Mansion, which for those who don't know was a four-bedroom mansion that he'd bought that was built on the site of a cottage that Harry Houdini had previously rented. And there was said to be paranormal activity at The Mansion, and I'm sure we'll talk about that in a little bit as well. Blood Sugar Sex Magic was actually the first of many albums to be recorded there. So over the years, the Chili's would return to The Mansion, and bands including Slipknot and Linkin Park would record there. Is there something to be said for recording in weird and wonderful places? I know that you'd said there that sometimes it's about getting out there and getting away from that sterile studio environment, regardless of what quality would come out of it.
I think it's cool. I think with the technology we have today with recording and at the cheap prices, and I mean, when you have really incredible microphones and really incredible equipment, does it make a difference? Yes. But of course they have that too. But I'm just saying, I think it's really flexible. I think nowadays you can get away with a lot because you have technology on so many ends too. You know, we've got such powerful computer programs for mixing and mastering, all kinds of things. And I think, yeah, and I believe there are things that add to the music that maybe cannot be defined or seen, or, and definitely if you're in a particular place that creates a certain atmosphere, paranormal or otherwise, or normal, that's, of course, everybody's feeling a vibe. So it's interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, to go into a bit more about that, Anthony Kiedis told Metal Hammer in 1991, we were completely gung-ho about the idea. We'd gone into the studio so many times and there'd always been this kind of anal retentive vibration.
Yeah.
Very sterile, high tech. So we thought how great it'd be if we actually moved into a house, lived and recorded there, how much warmer it would be and how much more we could isolate ourselves. Mm-hmm. And again, this is what we're saying, just creating this, you know, I'm obviously... an album speaks for itself, but I think when you have that information and you know, and you've seen Funky Monks, which again, we'll touch on in a little bit, you know, it just builds the story of this album even more.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a beautiful thing that they did it.
Yeah. So much has been said around the mansion being haunted. So Slipknot revealed many creepy goings on at the mansion when they recorded Volume 3, The Subliminal Verses. But there are also plenty of stories from the Blood Sugar Sex Magik sessions. Mm-hmm. Most of the band lived at the mansion while recording the album. As you'd said earlier on, Chad was too creeped out and he refused to stay.
Yeah.
Bless him.
Yeah.
John Frusciante, however, thought that the ghosts were friendly and actually gave us possibly a bit too much information. He's a bit of a pre-warning for those of you who might be easily offended out there. In an interview with Raw magazine, he said, "I heard a female ghost there. That was the only time I had any sexual experience there. I was sleeping in the hall and I got really turned on by this female ghost who was getting fucked above me, so I jacked off. The rest of the time, all my sexual energy went into my playing."
Funny.
And again, we'll touch on kind of the Red Hot Chili Peppers and this kind of sexuality that their music has, and the guys in the band as well as we go on. Yeah, so recording in a new environment had a huge effect on the band's creativity, as I'm sure you imagine it would, as they recorded all over the mansion.
Yeah.
Many commented that they would never be able to get a good drum sound recording in the mansion, but as Anthony put it to Raw magazine in 1991, we had all these drum experts up there saying, "You'll never get a good drum sound here," but they were totally wrong.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on the drum sound on this album?
To be honest, I just find the songs really well mixed and mastered and balanced, and no, that never occurred to me. Think critically about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm also, you know, everybody listens to music differently. When someone is vocalizing, I do tend to focus on that. It's not that I don't have good ears or that I can't select something out to listen for, but in general, I really love, like I said, his style of singing, and I love figuring out lyrics and singing along. So I do tend to focus on that.
Yeah. So, as we've said, the mansion was such a fertile creative environment for the band. They completed album sessions with 25 songs recorded. 17 of these made the final album.
Yeah.
So that makes it not only the first Rick Rubin album that we've covered on My Classic Album, it is, as we speak, the album that we've covered that has the most tracks on it.
Mm-hmm.
I usually find that once an album goes past 10 or 11 tracks, and this isn't always the case,
no,
we're in danger of approaching that kind of filler territory. That kind of, some of the best albums are kind of short and sweet. Once we're getting past 10 or 11, we're starting to get a bit of filler in there. Do you think this could have been a better album with less tracks, or do you think it's the best representation of the band at this point in their career?
No, for me, it was really, I have to say, I loved every single track. And that's, you're exactly right, because I've got some albums where I love them and maybe they have 16 tracks, but you know, I always skip track 7 and 8, or I really have to be in the mood for 13 or whatever it is. But on this one, that's kind of, I mean, I probably didn't explain it well, but that's kind of what I meant with the metaphor that you don't just go over one hill in this album, you go over multiple. And I don't mean that each song is a hill. I just mean that it takes, you know, kind of like the White Album with the Beatles. It is so long, but it gets a new energy within itself. And then I just want to keep listening and listening. It's so broad and full. So yeah, for me, I would not omit anything.
Cool. Cool. So just before we go track by track, which we're about to, I want to touch on a song that was recorded during these sessions, but ultimately wasn't included on the final album. As we said, there were 25 songs completed. Salt the Squeeze ended up as a B-side on both Give It Away and Under the Bridge.
I know.
Before being released as a single in its own right in 1993. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on Salt the Squeeze? And do you think that it should have ended up on the album?
I find this album too perfect, so no, but I loved the song. I loved it, and it kind of points towards the direction they continued in, you know, a little bit more the singer-songwriter. He went more to songs, not completely Anthony Kiedis, but, you know, the style. I don't know. I could be wrong. Like I said, I didn't follow them as closely after this album, but I loved that song, yeah.
Yeah. So we'll dive in track by track. We'll just get going. We'll start with The Power of Equality, a very politically charged song to kick off the album. Clash magazine believes that The Power of Equality has to have been influenced by the beating of Rodney King by four white police officers in California in March 1991 while the album sessions were underway. So this was a huge news story at the time in America. Yeah. Clash magazine go on to say that The Power of Equality reflects the anger that was palpable in the smog-filled air of LA, as Kiedis rallies against racism, oppression, and media-fueled fear in a colorblind call to arms. Mm-hmm. How does this song open the album for you? I guess I don't particularly view them as a political band. I mean, am I wrong there?
Yeah, nowadays that there's more internet and things available, I like to look at songs and meanings and whatnot. But in that time, I was more just listening to the music. I think that, though, however, if you take, obviously you hear that term over and over, the power of equality. So you know that they're singing about that. And I think it's a really nice, it opens so humbly with a sort of lo-fi introduction. And then they really just start rocking out. And yeah, for me, I could see that it could be a reflection of that occurrence and of that time. I'm from California, so I remember that all. And I remember that being such a big deal. I didn't know it, however, at the time. But I find it a powerful song, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess that's what's interesting, really, the great music, and we talk about this quite a lot, you know, they can have political themes or personal themes or whatever, but a great song is a great song, and that'll have meant something completely different to you when you were listening to it in 1991. For you, it was just a great song that you could sing along to. It was funky, it was great. But obviously, now, like you say, that we have the internet, we can pick apart these things, we can try and work out what people were talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So a lot has been said about the lyrical content of Chilly albums evolving after the death of guitarist Hillel Slovak in 1988. And we'll talk about him a bit more later on. The feeling seems to be that after Slovak's death, that the lyrics that Kiedis was writing went from kind of disposable good time fun to having something with more substance to say. And I know you just touched on a little bit there that you feel like after this album, he did drift into more kind of a singer-songwriter direction. Do you think that this song is a good example of that? That perhaps the lyrics are less good time fun and he's using his platform to say something now?
Yeah, I feel that, I mean, really throughout this whole album, he's very passionate and he's got something to say. And even whether it's, in this song, I feel it's passionate. I feel it's meaningful. And even if when I was a kid, you know, listening to this, if I didn't know exactly what it was, I'm also, I got to tell you, I'm not politically, I don't like to watch the news. I don't like to, there's so much going on, you know? Yeah, I definitely feel, and when someone is singing about something that they feel strongly about politically or whatnot, then again, you hear that, you feel that, that makes a song strong, can make the song strong.
So this is one of five songs on the album named by Music Radar amongst Flea's 9 funkiest bass lines. So Flea is certainly, you know, he's one of the most unique and celebrated bass players in music history. Yeah. Just how integral is Flea and his bass technique on the overall sound of this album? And indeed, the band in general, I guess.
Totally. I think totally. Yeah. I think they all matter so much.
And I guess that's the thing with great bands, especially when you've got these classic lineups of great bands as well, that it's everybody's playing their part. And it's just, it just creates this amazing, this amazing product at the end of it.
Yeah, because there's a magic between all of them together. But not just that, they all have their own individual thing that they bring. And that's wonderful.
So we'll move on to If You Have to Ask. So this was actually one of the singles chosen for release from the album. If You Have to Ask was ranked 22nd in Consequence of Sound's ranking of every Red Hot Chili Peppers song ever.
Okay.
They said everything's in the pocket, from Flea's bass rumbling to form the backbone of the song, to the falsetto vocals during the chorus, as if a trio of intergalactic backing singers had just emerged from the wings at a club show. There's some huge singles on this album, which we're going to come to soon. Do you think this song maybe gets forgotten sometimes, a little underrated in comparison to these big singles on the album?
In a way, yeah. But that's the thing. I think there's just so much quality on here. It some things have to sift to the bottom, you know? Not everything can be... But I do think it's a great song and very experimental vocalization things going on. And yeah, I think it's a cool song.
Yeah. So this one's a great example of John Frusciante's process throughout the recording of Blood Sugar Sex Magik. John wanted to get everything down in one take, if he could. He said in 2007... With a couple of exceptions, I knew exactly what I was going to do. I think at that time, I'm just completely improvising, and every solo has a real spontaneous...
Oh, how cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah, even haphazard feel to it. Yeah, that's something you weren't aware of. Do you get that feel?
I can see,
yeah.
that could be the case, and I think I'll listen to it for sure differently the next time I hear it. But yeah, absolutely. In a way, that song has a lot of... just crazy stuff going on. And they just sound like they're having fun. And I love listening to music when people sound like they're having fun.
Yeah. And I guess a really good example of that is the very end of the song, where obviously we've discussed here that John's improvised that. He's done that in one take. And at the end, everyone gives John a round of applause. And they've kept that in the song.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
I just love. And there's just something about that that kind of sums up the whole ethos around Blood Sugar Sex Magik better than any moment on the album.
Yeah, there's a lot of nice raw details they left in. And it's fantastic.
And that's Elizabeth Evans there chatting with me about her chosen album, Blood Sugar Sex Magik by the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And we'll get back to my chat with Elizabeth in just a bit. It's just a lot of fun to hear someone who has such a deep love for an album talk about it. I mean, I know that's what the podcast is about, but, you know, Elizabeth really captures that really well. And I hope that you love the album as much as she does, or if you've never heard it before, I hope that she's given you kind of an appetite to listen to it, because that's what this is all about, really. Coming up, just how does Under the Bridge explore perhaps the lowest point in Anthony Kiedis' life? And just why does he hate the greeting song? All that and more right after this. Enjoying this episode of My Classic Album? Don't forget there are loads of amazing albums covered in our previous episodes as part of Season 1, with guests including Guns N' Roses keyboardist Dizzy Reed.
If I had to pick one like favorite band or I guess a band that was the biggest influence on me, I would go with the Rolling Stones.
Blues guitarist Big Boy Blota.
It sounded great then and it sounded great now. It just seems to have stood the test of time with me anyway. So yeah, it's a real classic for me.
And Nathan Stevens Griffin of Martha.
It's a great song musically, you're absolutely right. It's a banger. Mm-hmm. It is like absolutely a barnstormer of an album opener right there.
Also, there's our anniversary episodes, such as 40 Years of Rumours with Fleetwood Mac, including an interview with engineer Ken Kelly.
Within about 15 minutes, the band was fighting. I've seen, you know, Crosby, Stills and Nash fight. I've seen Kenny Loggins and Jim Messina fight, but this was a weird, I've never seen couples fight.
And 40 Years of Bat Out of Hell, including an interview with the voice of Paradise by the Dashboard Light, Ellen Foley.
Time is sometimes tricky. Sometimes things seem like very long ago in another life, which it is, but it all, the memories of it and certainly the song itself is always sort of alive in my mind.
All these episodes and more are available at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk and on Podnos, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. So we'll move on now to Breaking the Girl.
Yeah.
Now, in 2019, and we've touched on this a little bit already, some of the most loved Red Hot Chili Peppers songs are ballads. They've drifted more into that kind of direction, sort of singer-songwritery, than maybe where they were in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
In 1991, the band had only attempted a ballad once before, with 1987's Behind the Sun. Mm-hmm. So Breaking the Girl in that sense feels like a very important track.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on Breaking the Girl, and how does it rank amongst these other moments where the Chili's turned things down?
Yeah, I think that song is one of my all-time favorites of the Red Hot Chili Peppers. I think it comes at the right moment in that album, you know, in the third song. And it takes you completely elsewhere with the acoustic guitar and the style with which he plays that. and it just completely works, and it has energy, and yet it's a ballad. It's fantastic.
So it's certainly at this point one of the most personal songs Anthony Kiedis has written, although as we've said, there are others coming later in the album that we could say the same for. This one chronicles his relationship with model Carmen Hawke. Do you know much about their relationship?
I don't know. I really only knew what was available to me at that time, and then later I never really looked, so I don't know about it.
Yeah. So this is what Anthony says about her in his autobiography, Scar Tissue.
Yeah.
He says she was off her rocker. I got her to go to therapy so she didn't kill herself. I kept trying unsuccessfully to end the relationship, but after I bought my house, she simply would not leave. She locked herself in the bathroom with a knife. She'd gone in there to cut her wrists, and I had to knock down the door to get to her. I finally bought her a plane ticket so she could go to model in Italy, and that was the end of our relationship. So this is a really tumultuous time in his life.
Terrible.
Yeah. I mean, interestingly, Breaking the Girl was only played once during the entire tour for Blood Sugar Sex Magik, and this was on opening night before they dropped it completely. Kiedis says that when they played it live, it simply fell apart. So they've only played it 16 times, according to Rolling Stone. I wonder if that is to do with that thought that they struggle to replicate it live, or I wonder if some songs are just too personal to play night after night. What are your thoughts on that?
That's a good question. I can't say. I definitely do think that some songs can be very personal, but I think in that song they also use some big garbage cans as percussive elements or something like that, big metal. So it is possible that maybe, but you know, people are creative. People can always make alternate live versions. Yeah. So I don't know. That's a good question. But if his girlfriend was really such an unstable person, maybe you would also not want to, go there.
Well, this is true. I'd thought of it from that perspective, actually. And it's interesting you should bring up the trash cans, because that is kind of one of the highlights of the song in some ways, that this kind of percussion interlude in the middle, which we've heard was apparently done with loads of kind of trash cans and junk and stuff that the band had found, and they included that on the album. So this is just another awesome example of just how creative things were during recording sessions.
Yeah, just so inspired. And when you're inspired, it's like you see things in the corner that you never saw before, but they've always been sitting there. Or, you know, it's great. Mm. Yeah.
So we'll move on to Funky Monks, which is our next track. This brings the tempo up slightly.
Yeah.
Clash Magazine saved the song. Funky Monks is a proud parading manifesto of a man openly seizing any opportunity to satisfy his sexual desires. For a long time, this kind of reputation followed the band around, and it threatened to overshadow the music a little bit. Do you think that with songs like Funky Monks, do you think that they maybe thrived on this reputation a bit? Or do you think it was kind of an anchor that was weighing them down?
That's a good question. I think that they believed in what they were doing, and they were being really open, speaking about sexuality. And to be honest, I think they were just doing whatever they wanted, and whether or not that was whatever effect that had on their public, I don't know. I don't think that during the writing process, at least, you're thinking about that if you're so inspired. And I don't know.
So Consequence of Sound says that Funky Monks has perhaps the funkiest intro and one of the most contagious hooks. Would you agree with that? Are there other tracks on the album that you think kind of turn the funk up even more?
I would agree with it.
Yeah. In terms of kind of the funkiness, is this kind of the peak, would you say?
Yeah, I would say so. Cool. It is so funky.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've touched a couple of times already on the documentary Funky Monks, which is obviously named after this song. So for those not in the know, it was a documentary made by Flea's brother-in-law, and it chronicles the production of Blood Sugar Sex Magik. For anyone who hasn't seen it, can you just kind of give us a bit of a snapshot as to what it's like, maybe any particular highlights that you enjoyed from it, and anything that just gives us more of an insight into what the deal is with just how great this album is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And before I do that, I just want to say one thing, that Apache Rose Peacock would be a contender for the funk too.
Yeah.
So I had to pop that in. But but no, that's a great documentary. I don't think it's so long, even maybe an hour or so. It's in black and white, all done in black and white. And I found the style really cool, because you see them kind of talking together and hanging out and experimenting together. And I feel that you really get a feeling for what it was like to be there recording. And be away from the world and just be in this creative space with your creative partners. And it seemed like a really positive atmosphere. So yeah, it's a great documentary. I recommend it. It's even on YouTube.
Awesome. I mean, I didn't realize it was on YouTube. If I can find it, I might even share it on the My Classic Album Facebook page. So yeah, have a look out for that, anyone who sees that, because it's absolutely worth watching. It's fantastic.
It really is.
So we'll move on to Suck My Kiss, mm-hmm. one of the most well-known songs in the album,
yeah,
arguably of their career in some ways. Suck My Kiss is vintage Red Hot Chili Peppers. It's a huge explosion of funk and everything we couldn't expect from the band. What are your thoughts on Suck My Kiss? Is this a highlight of the album for you? I know that mm-hmm. we'd said that obviously you felt the Funky Monks was as well.
Yeah, that's the problem. This album has so many highlights that I can't stop saying it. But yeah, no, this was absolutely, because I think it's also such a fantastic title of a song. Suck My Kiss, it's suggestive and it's pushy, and the song itself fits. It's perfect. Yeah. It's a highlight.
So we touched on, while we were chatting about Funky Monks, we did have a little chat about this sort of sexual reputation that the band had, mm-hmm. particularly in the early 90s. And Anthony talked in 1994 to Rolling Stone about this song in particular, and he makes a really kind of good point about this kind of sexual reputation that they have and how that would link to their music. Uh-huh. He said the correlation between hardcore funk music and sexuality is so undeniable that to write mm. about it and to sing about it seemed like the most natural thing in the world. So mm-hmm. we did it, and we still do it. Mm-hmm. The fact that things are so different today because of the dangerous nature of sexual activity doesn't mean you have to cut your sexuality. You just have to be more careful and more thoughtful, mm-hmm. which is a really interesting point. And bear in mind that he was saying this 25 years ago mm-hmm. now, and I think it mm-hmm. still rings true today, that if we consider that sexual climate in the early 90s,
yeah,
with the emergence of AIDS and the media and that decline mm-hmm. of that 80s glam rock, you know, yes. Poison, Motley Crue thing that was all about sex, it suddenly wasn't as cool to be sexually liberal anymore. Here were a band like the Red Hot Chili Peppers that were doing it, and obviously people had different opinions about it either side.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely an aspect that made me, you know, not play the songs for my mother, for example, or maybe if you had a friend nowadays, say, you could, that you wouldn't recommend it to because of the sexual content. But they were doing what they wanted, and I, you know, sex is a part of life, and I think that they were singing about it in a really interesting way, and sometimes playful, and sometimes, yeah, they were messing around with it, and you're right, in a totally different way than what had been done in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah. So, as we've said, so many people rank this song as one of their best. It is one of their most loved. I have, however, found some criticism mm-hmm. aimed at the song from comedian Ian Carmel, who, when asked to choose the song he hated most in the entire world, went for Suck My Kiss. I'm just going to quote from him here. He says, there's no reason that it should exist. He says, suck my kiss in it, but it's not romantic and it's not sexual either. It's just kind of gross.
Yeah.
It sounds the way the inside of a Hooters looks. It's that kind of vibe. I'm not against the Red Hot Chili Peppers. I don't think they're laying white boy funk or whatever people say. I think they have some good songs.
Yeah.
There's just something about that song that's so unacceptable to me.
Yeah.
Does he have a point, or do you think that maybe he's kind of taking it a bit too seriously?
Well, I think that any time a song can become controversial, loved or hated, it's a good sign because it's strong. So
yeah,
for him, it has a point. That's not my opinion about the song, but yeah, I always think that if someone can become passionate about art, that's good, even if it's negative.
Totally, yeah. So we'll move on to I Could Have Lied. Mm-hmm. So this is another intimate moment from Anthony Kiedis. This one is, once again, about a relationship gone wrong. We've said already, this is new territory for the band. And obviously from someone like yourself who had somewhat followed them beforehand, is that part of the appeal of this album? Like, obviously we've said about how funky it is, but... Mm-hmm. We all love music we can relate to on a personal level.
Yeah. Yeah, I found this amazing that they suddenly had this tender song in the midst of this. And yeah, after having never done it before, Breaking the Girl, whilst you could call that a ballad, it's still quite active. And this, I found this a really beautiful moment in the album, that mm-hmm. it takes things down a notch. Your ear has a break. Also, you... It's contrast, and I found it a beautiful song, yeah.
So I Could Have Lied did come off the heels of Anthony's relationship with Sinead O'Connor. It should be pointed out that Sinead actually denies any kind of relationship with Anthony at any point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he told Clash magazine in 2010, "I was in a short-lived relationship with a girl, and I had fallen so head over heels for her. I went to visit her one night, and she had just left me a note saying, 'I've moved back to England. I won't be seeing you again.' I was literally standing there on a rare rainy night in LA, just beside myself. And for some reason, I called John. I was like, 'John, you're not going to believe this. She left me to go back to England, and she didn't even say goodbye.' And he's like, 'Get over here right now. We're writing about this right now.'"
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's a moment to channel it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there's something so restrained about the whole song. Everyone's just hanging back a little bit. It really creates this mood, which you totally get from the story of him standing in the rain alone. You get that image so bold, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. I didn't know that, so that's interesting. But absolutely, it has a withheld feeling. You're right.
Yeah. So, I mean, interestingly, EnmoreAudio.com revealed that I Could Have Lied and Breaking the Girl are the first two Red Hot Chili Peppers songs to include acoustic guitar. So I guess this makes me think about Californication again. So that was John Frusciante's comeback album with the band. Mm-hmm. There is a heavy influence of acoustic guitar in some of those songs. And again, something just a little different is ever present on that album from what we've heard before as well. So there's a few parallels between the two albums, I think, in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree.
So we'll move on to Mellowship Slinky in B major. There seems to be some debate as to whether this song is even in B major, with both Song Facts and Clash claiming the song is in D minor. Now, I love music, but I don't have a musical bone in my body. From what I can gather, John is playing in D minor, but Flea is playing in B major, which gives us that major funky feel to the track.
Yeah.
Can you give us any context on this? Or
To be honest, I never checked. I just sang along. But if that would be the case, then that I think that would make an interesting relationship to have the D minor and the B major. I like third relationships in music, and that's cool.
So Consequence of Sound ranked this one 16th in their all-time Red Hot Chili Peppers list, saying it skyrockets from heavy to funky to spacey and back within a space of 4 minutes. It wasn't a single. It would never be a single. And it's been played live instrumentally once, but never with vocals. But who cares? If you want to hear this band mix their 90s sound with funk, this is the best song to do it. Would you agree that this is the best example of the Red Hot Chili Peppers truly embracing funk? Would you agree with that? Or do you think there's other tracks where you think that they go further?
That's a good question. You know, I would have to not commit to that, to saying, and I can't sadly enough suggest another thing, but I'm definitely, I can see why they would make such a comment. Yeah. I'm in between. I'm sorry.
No, that's absolutely fine. We'll move on to The Righteous and the Wicked.
Yeah.
So there's 17 tracks on an album. Some, no doubt they're going to be overlooked, or as we were discussing earlier, there's that worry of some of them being regarded as filler. Mm-hmm. Ultimate Guitar named The Righteous and the Wicked among the band's 10 most underrated songs of all time. So the verse in The Righteous and the Wicked is a beautiful example of how less is more with regards to guitar work. Do you think this is part of why the album stood out so much upon its release? That as far as John Frusciante is concerned, there's no fear of restraint, as we were talking about. He's kind of improvising as he goes along.
Yeah, I think that adds a lot because it lives. It's alive. You're more in the moment. It's more raw. Also, he's using different kinds of guitars and different techniques and improvising. And I really like this song, actually. I listened to it a lot of times. I didn't skip over it. And I think it's a strong song as well.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting, if we kind of place this album back in 1991 when it was released, and we think about what's going on at the time. So grunge is really coming through.
Yes.
This album was released on the same day as Nevermind by Nirvana, which for many people is one of the greatest albums of all time.
Yeah, that's an excellent album too.
You've got bands like Metallica. They've just released the Black Album. That's absolutely huge. Mm-hmm. The biggest band in the world at this point, arguably, are Guns N' Roses. Really big bands. And their use of guitar is loud. It's often layered in the case of Guns N' Roses and Metallica.
Yeah.
He is John, showing some nuance and a bit of subtlety when required. He's really standing out against these kind of guitar heroes that we have in the 90s.
And if I'm not wrong, wasn't his big guitar hero Jimi Hendrix?
I believe so, yes.
I think so. I don't know, but that's also just such a cool and unique guitarist. And yeah, matching that style matches with funk. And I find John Frusciante extremely important and an amazing composer and musician.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll move on to Give It Away. Certainly one of the best known songs, not only on this album, but in the band's entire career.
Yeah.
Give It Away was the lead single for Blood Sugar Sex Magik. It was released a couple of weeks before the album was put out. What are your thoughts on Give It Away, not only as a song, but as a lead single for this album? Was it a strong choice?
I think so. Yeah, I do think so. Because I think that vocally, it's so catchy and well thought of. I mean, the vocals, the text is so cool, and you want to just sing along and you want to dance. You know, I think it's good to put a song forward with so much energy like this one has. And yeah, I think it was a good idea.
Yeah. So interestingly, much of what would become Give It Away came from John and Flea's time working with the side project Hate in 1990. And the rhythm that they crafted was even played during some of their live shows. But when that band disbanded, the Chili's built on what John and Flea had started. Now, I'd never heard of this side project before. I'm guessing kind of from your reaction, you hadn't either.
Nope, I have not.
No, so that's something definitely for me to have a look into, because it sounds like, I wonder how much of that funk carries over into there, particularly the kind of a defining song from the Red Hot Chili Peppers had its genesis in this side project.
Yeah, interesting. I'll have to look into that too.
Yeah. So Anthony Kiedis just disclosed in Scar Tissue that the recording of Give It Away gave birth to a ritual of sorts that the band has in the studio that they still do to this day. So if they're struggling with a composition or they're disagreeing with the direction of a song, the band would engage in what they call a face-off. So in this instance, Flea and John couldn't agree on guitar or bass progressions on the bridge for Give It Away.
Uh-huh.
So they went away separately, composed parts of the song, and then when the band got back in the studio, they would face off and then choose which part worked the best.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah, so like I said, they've apparently done this since, but I think that's a really hugely fascinating way to do it. And I would love to be able to see that play out. I almost wish that was in Funky Monks, that we could see some of that kind of playing out.
Yeah, that would be interesting. That would be really fun to watch, because there's all kinds of ways to move through the chords. And it's great.
So I actually, we've talked about Anthony Kiedis' vocals having more to say, and I love the lyrical message behind this song. So it was inspired by another of his relationships with ex-girlfriend Nina Hagen, who he was with as he was going through his heroin addiction.
Uh-huh.
And so from what he says, she once gave him a jacket out of her wardrobe that he liked, her reason being that it gave her joy to give things away instead of keeping them for herself.
Oh, okay.
So Anthony says in Scar Tissue, it was such an epiphany that someone would want to give me her favourite thing. That stuck with me forever. Every time I'd be thinking, I have to keep, I'd remember, no, you've got to give away instead. Mm-hmm. And as I've said, I think that's just such a powerful message from a song that some people might think is disposable. You know, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, sometimes some people think they're a disposable band. I would disagree. But that's a really powerful and quite unique message in a song.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I didn't know it was about that. But that is beautiful.
Yeah. So Give It Away proved to be the song that kickstarted the Chili's journey into mainstream notoriety, as the song infiltrated rock radio. Teamed up with a now iconic video that played on MTV. Give It Away marked their first number one in the US. It proved a huge hit over here in the UK a couple of years later.
Uh-huh.
What is it about this song that made it such a huge turning point for the band?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit lighter than some of the other ones in terms of how they use their instruments in it, and it's so catchy, and it has a positive vibe to it, definitely. Even if you don't know what it's about. And anyway, even just that term, Give It Away, there is something, mildly positive in that. Yeah, I think it's just, it's catchy, you know, it's danceable, you want to move your body when you hear it, and it's not heavy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I would guess that's why.
So Give It Away won a Grammy Award for Best Hard Rock Performance, and it's been included in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's 500 Songs That Shaped Rock, along with many other accolades over the years. Bearing in mind that 1991 was the year that grunge really dominated the music scene, we talked about how this album came out the same day as Nevermind. Do you think that Give Away's importance in rock history is sometimes understated and forgotten as a result?
No. I wouldn't say so. You're always a product of the world, and the world around you is existing. I think it's dangerous to try to take something out of context and say, oh, it would have been better if, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So we'll move on to Blood Sugar Sex Magik, our title track. So this is a really good example, and there are many more in the discography of this band, of Anthony Kiedis, as we've talked about, in his most kind of carnal and sexual almost. Mm-hmm. He's talked a lot about the role of sexuality and his music, and we had a quote earlier on about that. As I say, you know, we've talked a bit about how in some ways people worry that could be possibly an albatross around their neck. Do you think it's a strength of their music that there's such a sexual element to it?
Mm-hmm. Definitely, because I think sexuality, it's always, especially in America, it's funny, it has the biggest porn industry, but they don't show any nudity on the television. Or I don't know nowadays, I haven't lived there for a while, but when I was a child, it's so taboo. Nudity and those things in the public eye, it's not done at all, but yet you see, it's not that there is no sexuality, it's not that drive isn't there, or that doesn't exist. And sometimes I think maybe that is why the porn industry is the way it is there. Mm-hmm. And I think this all relates to the Red Hot Chili Peppers in the sense that they're not afraid to talk about it. And I think that has even more impact when you consider the context of them being in America, where sexuality, it's everywhere. It has a kind of, there's a border where it becomes taboo. But there, you know, it's interesting. So I think that it's important, and I think that people who love them do respect that about them, or that matters, or feel that helps them maybe understand something that was difficult for them to understand with sexuality. I don't know.
Yeah. So, I mean, Clash magazine saves the song. It's explicit and alluring, everything rock and roll should be. But in his uncensored celebrations of the flesh, Anthony is often cast as a sex obsessive, as if this somehow devalues his art. Do you think there's something to that, that people just dismiss the band as a result of kind of like sex obsessed fiends and ignore what great music
definitely
is there?
Because there's a lot of people scared to be open about these subjects. Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we'll move on to Under the Bridge. Now, this probably is the biggest and most beloved song in the back catalogue of the band. The perfect retort to those critics who say that the band only sing about sex. It's one of the most personal songs that we'll ever talk about on my classic album. Anthony explores feelings of loneliness and reflects on his days struggling with a heroin addiction.
Yeah.
Before we delve deeper into Under the Bridge, what are your initial thoughts on this song? And do you hold it in as high regard as everybody else does?
Yeah, I love the song. It was so loved that it was played over and over and over and over and over. But no, when I first heard it and when I first listened to the album, it was also absolutely a highlight and a beautiful song and sad and a great expression.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting, we will talk more about what was actually happening in his life that inspired the song itself. But during the recording of Blood Sugar Sex Magik, he'd been sober for 3 years at this point. He'd found himself feeling quite isolated during the sessions when Flea and John would smoke weed together, something which, of course, he was no longer into. It was something he no longer did. And it was that loneliness that he says triggered memories of his time with his ex-girlfriend.
Yeah.
And how, in his words, I had this beautiful angel of a girl who was willing to give me all of her love. And instead of embracing that, I was downtown with gangsters shooting speedballs under a bridge. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, this is a song with a truly deep and personal attachment for him.
Yeah.
And what are you going to think? A very brave move for him to include it on an album like this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, think it works really well. It's beautiful.
Absolutely. So interestingly, our last episode of My Classic Album was about the Black Album by Metallica. That includes Nothing Else Matters. So this is another deeply personal song that James Hetfield didn't write with Metallica in mind. He just kind of wrote for himself. He wasn't going to share it. And it took the rest of the band and Bob Rock to discover it to convince him to let them record the song.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Similarly, it was Rick Rubin who, upon seeing the lyrics in Kiedis' notebook, urged him to share Under the Bridge with the band. And he didn't think that was a Chili's kind of song either. So, I mean, isn't it amazing that, you know, and again, within the same time period, the early 90s, these great songs, and there are many other examples of this, they nearly end up as kind of words in a notepad or thoughts in someone's head, rather than these kind of iconic landmarks in people's careers.
That's when you can see it's so important to have good people around you, people who want to contribute to your art or encourage you. And because I think as an artist, there are certain things you feel really comfortable with, but certain areas that are so personal that you may be afraid or hold back on. And that's why it's great to have an outside perspective like Rick Rubin.
Yeah, absolutely. So Anthony talked to Rolling Stone in 1992, and this kind of is a lot more about what he's actually singing about, the kind of during his heroin addiction. So he says, I ran into some fairly unscrupulous characters involved with mafioso drug rings. And the hangout for one of these gangs was this particular location under a bridge. I ended up going there with this gang member. The only way I was allowed to go under this bridge was for him to tell everybody else that I was getting married to his sister. You had to be family to go there. That was just one of hundreds of predicaments I found myself in, the kind that only drug addiction can bring about. It's not that one place was more insidious than other places, but that's just one day that sticks very vividly in my memory. Mm-hmm. How could I let myself get to that point? I guess, and I've heard him say similar things at the time, this is arguably the lowest point, the lowest moment in his life that he's seen. Mm-hmm. And I guess I just think that, you know, we've been talking about how kind of people think this band is so sexual. We talk about how people dismiss them as kind of throwaway. But here's someone really pouring their heart out about a very real event. And it just makes for an amazing, amazing song.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You see more sides to him as an artist. And I think that's great when you're a fan of people's music. It's like when you really can love someone's music, you just want to learn more about them and what the songs are about and things like that. And that gives more depth, definitely. Yeah,
absolutely. Vocally, this marks a turning point for Anthony as well, who usually sang very quickly, whereas here he sings a lot slower and in a lower register. Do you think that this is kind of foreshadowing? Again, we've talked about Californication a few times. Yeah. I feel this song would fit very well on an album like Californication. Do you think that this is kind of foreshadowing what was to come in the future?
Totally. Yeah, I agree with that 100%. Yeah.
So the band didn't initially see the song as a single, but after it proved popular at live shows, Under the Bridge became the second single from Blood Sugar Sex Magik. So if Give It Away started their journey to superstardom, Under the Bridge sealed it. It was a huge hit across the world and mainstay in the band's set lists. What kind of an impact has this song had, not only on the band, we've touched on that a little bit there, but on their legions of fans? It's obviously had a huge impact.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that is exactly that beauty of expression. It's so, there's so much truth in that song, and it's really, that's a thing that I can say, you can't measure everything, you can't say sometimes why something moves you so much, but that song is very moving.
So like many deeply personal songs, we find that sometimes the writer can grow quite distant from their work. Anthony Kiedis grew disenchanted with Under the Bridge over the years. However, in 2007, he told iTunes that although there have been times when I was over it, I've rediscovered it, and now I feel close to it, and it still has power, life, and purpose as a song. What keeps us, and Anthony, I guess, returning to that song time and time again?
Yeah, maybe because it is, I mean, if you're singing about the lowest point in your life, I can imagine that, yeah, that's incredibly moving. But of course, if you have to do that 300 times a year, you have to somehow develop a different relationship with the song, like you just said. But it is just in its essence moving. And I think, yeah, it has something essential in it that makes you able to return to it as a listener or as a performer.
Yeah. So our next track is Naked in the Rain. So we're getting back over to that up-tempo funk rock sound. Now, something that's on this song that's surprisingly absent throughout the rest of the album, and it's something that the band are quite renowned for, is that presence of slap bass from Flea. So there are many listening today who, upon mentioning slap bass, their mind will instantly go to Flea. He's very renowned for that kind of technique.
Yeah.
But as we've said, there isn't a whole lot of that on this album. Do you think that the album suffers from a lack of slap bass, or do you think that it's interesting to see Flea try something else?
Yeah, I definitely like to see him trying something else, even though the slap bass is great too. But I think it's great to always keep moving forward and trying new things. And then you bring more into your palette, and that's only good.
Yeah. So Edmore Audio explained that it was Rick Rubin's influence that led to this kind of more minimal bass presence on the album. Flea elaborated on this for Guitar Magazine around the album's release. He said, "I consciously avoided anything busy or fancy. I tried to get small enough to get inside the song, as opposed to stepping out and saying, 'Hey, I'm Flea, the bitchin' bass player.' I hardly slap it all on the new record, aside from Naked in the Rain." Mm-hmm. With that in mind, is this the point in the album that showcases Flea, the bitchin' bass player? Is this that moment where he gets to step forward and have his time?
Yeah, maybe you could see it like that. I didn't listen to the song with that in mind. I will the next time. But yeah, in a way, it's good that they have one. You know, like I say, variety is good. It's nice to move on and try new things and try new styles. But it's also good to draw from the palette of things that you have. And that creates also contrast for a listener. And
yeah.
Yeah.
So as we've touched on a few times, there's 17 tracks on this album. So we're on track 12 at this point. Pitchfork have gone on record as saying that it's hard not to notice that a quarter of the record could be lost at no harm, singling out Naked in the Rain and our next track, Apache Rose Peacock, as redundant in their words.
Oh my.
I was gonna ask your opinion on this, but I think from that reaction I already knew it.
Well, Naked in the Rain, funnily enough, is one of my least favorites of the album. Mm-hmm. But Apache Rose Peacock is absolutely humongous highlight. I love that song. I think it's so creative, and I can see how it kind of comes towards the end, because the form of the song is kind of experimental, and I just love the way the transformations that happen in that song. So no, I would not agree about, I mean, I think Naked in the Rain is still good enough to be on the album, you know. It's just one of the less wonderful songs.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about Apache Rose Peacock.
Yeah.
Obviously, for you, it's an album highlight. And that was my next question, because Anthony Kiedis has gone on record in the past to say that this is his favourite song on the album.
Oh, how funny. Yeah.
And my question was going to be, would you agree with Pitchfork that it was redundant? Or would you agree with Anthony that it was a highlight of the album? And I guess we know which way you'd go.
For me, sometimes when I would come to that point, if I could really hear the whole album, I would often think, this is the best song on the album too. But then again, there's just so many great ones. But that song is so fun to sing along with, and it's such a, the chord progressions are so beautiful. I love it.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, I love it too, and I think it is a very underrated song on the album, particularly when you think of kind of Pitchfork's verdict on it. It has some really cool elements to it that may get forgotten, including kind of Flea paid somewhat of a tribute to Louis Armstrong by performing trumpet and duties on the track.
So
obviously we've talked about Flea the bitchin' bass player. How do you rate Flea the bitchin' trumpeter on this one?
I love it. Yeah, he's great. Works. It totally works. He's bitchin'.
So we talked about certain songs kind of getting played a lot, some songs getting played less so in a live setting. Apache Rose Peacock, from what I can gather, has only played twice that we know of in the band's entire career.
Oh.
Is that something of a missed opportunity?
Yes, that's a pity.
But I guess anyone who's listening who's seen them live and happened to be there for that will probably feel really good. I'm thinking, well, they've only played it twice, I was there.
Yeah, great. Exactly. You know, I had tickets to go to this tour, and they were going to perform with Nirvana in San Francisco. I guess it must have been 92, or I don't know when they toured. But Anthony Kiedis got sick and they canceled it. And they never rescheduled, but so sad. I was very sad. But anyway, so I've never seen him live, actually.
I saw that, not with John, it was 2011. So it was Josh had just joined the band and they'd released I'm With You, and we went to see them. And it was a fantastic show, but there was part of me wishing that John was there, to be perfectly honest. But I mean, it was a great show. It was fantastic.
Oh, cool that you saw them.
Yeah. So we'll move on to the greeting song. So we've been having this chat about songs being kind of filler or redundant, as Pitchfork put it. Anthony Kiedis has gone on record to say that he hates the greeting song, claiming that he was pushed to write it by Rick Rubin. He says, "To this day, I hate this song. I hate the lyrics. I hate the vocals." Mm-hmm. Do you see where he's coming from? Is it harsh criticism? What's going on there?
Yeah, this is not a highlight for me. But interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Anthony's hatred of the song seems to come from the fact, we were just talking about Under the Bridge a few minutes ago, you couldn't pick two songs that are kind of more polar opposites for where they've come from. Under the Bridge is such a personal, meaningful song from life experience.
Yeah.
Anthony's distaste for this song is because it was essentially written to order for Rick. You know, yeah. It's a song about cars. It didn't feel genuine for Anthony Keats at the time. Does that come across? Is there kind of a disingenuous kind of vibe to it compared to some of these other songs?
Yeah, maybe that's what I didn't like about it. It's possible.
Yeah, and I guess that's it. Obviously, this is the album where Anthony's really poured his heart out, you know, talking about these relationships that he's had. Yeah. It is a very personal album. Maybe in some ways the greatest song, particularly for Anthony, more than anyone, will stick out for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. I agree.
Yeah. So we'll move on to My Lovely Man.
Yeah.
So we've talked a lot already about the death of Chile's first guitarist, Hillel Slovak. Mm-hmm. And this is the point in the album where Anthony addresses that relationship with him and explores it. So in a 1990 interview, Anthony said the following about Hillel and his passing. He says, "It was the most atrocious thing I've ever encountered. I was very close to Hillel and I loved him very much. He was one of the most beautiful people I've ever shared my life with. And then in one instance, he was gone.
Yeah.
No one expected it. And a totally mind-boggling sadness just overcame everybody. For about a month or so, no one even considered the band. What we went through was a very private, twisted grief session."
Mm-hmm.
So I know that you said you listened to those previous albums that Slovak played on.
Mm-hmm.
How did they, obviously him and John were very different guitarists. How much of an impact did his death have on the band? Both negative and positive in some ways, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad that it happened. It's sad that they all had to go through that. I think that when he was the guitarist of the band, I think the music changed a lot when John came, absolutely. And it was really more funk. And like you said, too, lyrically, it was just kind of more silly or fun, and which I didn't mind either. You know, I thought that was cool, even though John was young too when he came to the band, wasn't he 18 or something?
Yeah.
Something like that. But that melted so well as well. It's just sad that Hillel left because he died, and he didn't just leave because he left. So
yeah, exactly. And I mean, what makes this song unique, that although it's in memory of Hillel in some ways, it's actually a very upbeat song. It's very typical of what we'd kind of expect of the band at this point. Clash magazine said of the song, "In mirroring the guitar and bass riff in the verses and emboldened by Chad's unwavering reinforcement on drums, the band are united in their grief and indelibly linked by their allegiance to salute Slovak in the only way he would have wanted, by rocking out hard." And in that sense, I couldn't agree more. It's a perfect tribute at this point of the album for their fallen friend.
Yeah, I agree. It has a positive energy to it. The title is positive. That it's a sad subject, but in a way, it's like they're coming to terms with it.
So we'll get towards the end of the album now. We'll move on to Say Psycho Sexy. So in many ways, a true highlight of the album. The song follows the misadventures of Sir Psycho Sexy and his many sexual exploits. Classic Rock Review say that the song has a bit of a Frank Zappa quality to it. Musically accompanying porno-level, explicitly sexual lyrics.
Yeah.
Do you kind of agree there's kind of a Zappa-esque vibe to this
song? Yeah, I absolutely love the song. I love it to bits. It's the chord progression is incredible, and the energy with which he sings and it is so explicit. I mean, when I first heard that, I was pretty young, and it's like I just laughed. It was so brilliant. But a Zappa feel. Yeah, I would say so.
What's interesting, talking about listening to that when you were quite young, a lot has been said about the gratuitous lyrics on this song. Now, obviously, some people have a problem with it, other people don't. A very good friend of mine, who's very excited that we're doing this album on My Classic Album.
Oh, cool.
He has no issue with his daughter listening to it. His daughter's 6 years old. Blood Sugar Sex Magic is her favourite album. It's got great taste. And he said, we had a bit of a chat about this, and he was like, as far as he's concerned, that, as you know, there's nothing wrong with her hearing this kind of stuff, as long as she's aware that she shouldn't repeat it, or that if she repeats it in certain company, that people would be upset. So he's got a very kind of a very cool dad attitude towards it, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
When Rolling Stone asked Anthony Kiedis about this song in particular, he said the following: "If parents think their child can't handle the language that I use, then they shouldn't expose their kids to it. That's more up to the parents than me." Mm-hmm. And again, I think my friend Drew encapsulates that quote really well. What are your thoughts on the song lyrically? Would you agree with that it is more up to kind of the parents to judge what people shouldn't be listening to at certain ages?
Yeah, Yeah, it's not. I mean, they're making art. They're not in charge of who hears it. You know, there is a parental sticker thing on that CD. It's explicit. That's clear. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, it's the responsibility of the parents or the individual.
Yeah,
definitely.
So this one has an 8-minute runtime. Even 16 tracks deep, this song really stands out on this album. Clash magazine say the song, though only the penultimate track on Blood Sugar Sex Magik, so Psycho Sexy is unquestionably its climax. Formidable yet luring, primitive yet majestic, obscene yet sensuous. It condenses into 8 minutes the very essence of Blood Sugar Sex Magik as a complete snapshot of four virile and venturesome 20-something companions in the heady summer of 1991. Would you agree with that idea that this is kind of a snapshot of what the album is about?
Yeah. I think I found it so brilliant that they put it, okay, it's not the last track, but I always kind of think of it as a last track, but to put it at the end of the album, it is, I think its explicitness and the subject, it's so cool to juxtapose that against this musical genius. I mean, really, I think the song, if you just look at it without any lyrics, without any text, it's so perfect. It's beautifully written. It moves from place to place wonderfully. The form is experimental. And then you put over that these crazy offensive, you know, or to many people. And that almost, I don't say it takes away from the beauty, but it's just two totally different things together and that works so well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So obviously that isn't the final track, but our final track is They're Red Hot. Mm-hmm. Now, this is actually a cover version. It was originally performed by blues singer Robert Johnson. Now, I'm listening to a lot of Robert Johnson at the moment, funnily enough. One of my favourite bands, Blackstone Cherry, are releasing a blues EP, and they've covered a Robert Johnson track that is the lead single on that EP. So I am listening to a lot of his stuff at the moment. I guess it'd be interesting to kind of listen to that one and then see how the Chilis kind of make it their own.
Yeah, I'll have to do that. That's good to know. I remember in Funky Monks, in the documentary about the making of this album, I believe towards the end they do show them recording this outside in the middle of the night or something. Yeah. Isn't that true? So I knew that, but somehow I missed that it was a cover. I didn't realize that. So I'll have to go back and listen.
A really cool story about Robert Johnson that I'm sure anyone who's familiar with him will know. People who don't, this is a really cool story. It's kind of an urban myth around him that he really wanted to be this legendary, phenomenal guitar player and wasn't. Until he went out and he met a mysterious figure in the middle of the night who tuned his guitar for him, gave him it back. And they say that what happened was that he sold his soul to the devil that night. The devil tuned his guitar and then he was this legendary blues guitarist, which is just the ultimate story about anyone. I absolutely love it.
Yeah, that's great.
And I think that what's cool is that, you know, even covering something from Robert kind of with that kind of history that he's got, that just enhances the cool factor of this album. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty cool album already.
Yeah. But that's cool.
Yeah. So I feel, you know, some people might think Psycho Sexy. I think this is the perfect track to close the album. And due to something that you'd said earlier on, that on the Funky Monks documentary, it does show this bit where they all gather outside the mansion at 2 o'clock in the morning. And what they recorded that night is what we hear on the album.
Yeah, and that is so cool.
Yeah, and I just think it's the perfect snapshot of this band. We've gone through 17 tracks, and this is the snapshot of where they were at that point in their lives, and I just love how it comes together.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more.
So with that in mind, how does They're Red Hot end the album for you?
Yeah, I think it just takes the edge off of... So Psycho Sexy is so beautiful and so majestic. That was really a perfect word. It's to end with that would have been possible, but this kind of keeps it playful for me. Yeah. So, yeah, I think it works.
Cool. So it's an album that took the Red Hot Chili Peppers and it catapulted them into rock immortality while keeping the essence of what makes them truly unique. Nicholas Burton at Red Brick sums up the album nicely. He says the album effortlessly flows from one song to another, so much so that sometimes it's hard to tell when the last song ended and the new one begins. It acts as one continuous joy of inspiration, funk rock beauty that never stops until the very last second of the album. It all blends together as one funktastic ride, which will make your booty wiggle and jiggle like the last time you danced to Michael Jackson. With that in mind, how does Blood Sugar Sex Magik stand the test of time for you?
I love it still. Yeah, it's funny. When I listened to it, I listened to it on tape. So I didn't also, I often didn't know when the song started and ended because, you know, with a CD, that's different. You see it flip from number to number. But that description, I can really relate to it. I agree with that. And I think it withstands the test of time. I mean, I think it's still musically really interesting and experimental.
Yeah, absolutely. And finally, why is Blood Sugar Sex Magik your classic album? And why should people check it out if they haven't already?
Yeah, I feel that listening to that album is such a fulfilling journey of fantastic music that's varied and unique and experimental and beautiful and inspiring.
A huge thanks to Elizabeth there for chatting with me about her chosen classic album, Blood Sugar Sex Magik. And it's interesting, you know, I've recently converted over to a MacBook to do the podcast and to do the interviews. And this was the first time that I've actually used Skype itself to record a Skype call when I've been chatting with someone. And it's a really good thing I did. I had some pretty major technical difficulties on my side in terms of picking up my audio. And Elizabeth could hear it, but I couldn't, which was really strange. So we just kind of persevered. And when I got to the end of the call, thankfully the Skype call, what you've heard there, came out fine. But my audio didn't, that I usually record on Audacity, which was really bizarre. But we got there, you know, obviously there was plenty there. And thankfully you got to hear it all. You know, it's very rare that we have these technical difficulties on my classic album, but sometimes they happen, unfortunately. We talk about the Red Hot Chili Peppers being really experimental and influential people. I think you can really hear that in Elizabeth's music too, that there's a lot of experimentation going on and there's just a deep love of music. So get yourself over to elizabethevetts.com and just see everything that she's up to at the moment. And so that's it for another edition of My Classic Album. Thank you so much for joining me. Our next episode of My Classic Album, we'll be looking at an instrumental album for the first time in the history of the podcast. We'll be looking at Joe Satriani's Surfing with the Alien. And my special guest, Sam Russell, will be joining me to break that album down. And as always, to go through it track by track. So join me and Sam on the next episode of My Classic Album. I'm looking forward to seeing you all there. Cheers.